I'd rather kill you than see you working a shit job for just enough money to buy cheese and watch television. Chuck Palahniuk, Fight Club. Hello, I'm Kennedy Weibel.
And I'm Rebecca Capone.
And this is Reading Pop Classics, the podcast where we discuss modern literary classics, books that had a substantial impact on the zeitgeist and continue to endure today. Today, we are discussing the 1996 novel Fight Club by Chuck Palahniuk. This was Palahniuk's... How do you say that name?
I say Palahniuk.
Palahniuk. This was Palahniuk's first published novel. The first one he wrote was Invisible Monsters, but publishers turned that one down for being too dark. This book, Fight Club, was mostly well-reviewed when it came out, but it was, at the time, just another... totally fine, mostly well-reviewed novel, didn't make a big splash until the movie came out in 1999. And while the movie was a box office flop, it became huge on DVD and video. And in 1999, both Invisible Monsters and Survivor were published, putting Palahniuk at three novels. And now he's got 19 published novels, three nonfiction books, graphic novels, adult coloring books. He's published short stories, and he is currently just living as a working novelist. He has a forthcoming novel, Shock Induction, that is meant to come out soon. I don't know. We're not a publishing industry podcast, but it's coming. I suppose I could look it up. Okay, it's coming out October 8th, so by the time you're listening to this, his 20th novel will be out. So, Rebecca, to start, tell me, did you see the movie first, or did you read the book first?
It's interesting that you asked that, because I have actually been trying to remember that, because both of those were... What year did the movie come out?
The movie came out in 1999, and it probably had its... DVD and VHS pop in 2000, I would think, just given my sketchy memory of the timelines between like theaters and home rental back in the day.
I honestly do not remember which of these came first for me, but there is actually a pretty good chance that it was the book, because I do remember being pretty young when I read it. I do actually think I was in like the 9th or 10th grades, which would have been 99 and 2000. 98.
Okay. I mean, I think you probably had
98
my...
to 2000.
You probably had my copy.
I had your copy.
I saw the movie first, and no matter what, I can't undo that. So the book for me is a thing that I read second. Like the movie was the first text, as far as I understood Fight Club, and then I read the book afterwards.
If you saw the movie first and then read the book, and I read your copy, I probably also saw the movie first and then read the book. Because I think I remember not being surprised at the end of the book.
I saw it first. The main thing I remember when I read the... I mean, I wasn't surprised by the book either. I knew what was coming, and I was surprised by how faithfully some of it adheres, like line by line, dialogue, everything to the book. And the thing that I was a little bit worried about, so I read this over and over again when it came out. Like, I saw the movie 100 times. I read the book 100 times. And it's been a while. And going back to it, a little bit nervous. There's been a lot said about this book and the people who like it, the movie and the people who like it. One of the things that I was pleasantly surprised by revisiting it now as an adult, more of an adult anyway, it's a good book. Like, it's written well. Palahniuk's use of language is really interesting. I think the like choruses and the refrains and the way he's presented it here is actually very creative, and I think it's engaging, and I think it's part of the staying power of both the movie and the book.
I agree with that, and I was reading an article when I was kind of doing research and stuff for the book. I read an article that was also basically like, you know what we never talk about when we talk about Fight Club is the fact that it's a really good book and it's very well written.
I mean, I have problems with it, but
you know,
it's a well-written book.
I read this at least a couple times in high school, and I've seen the movie dozens of times. And you know what I was thinking? I'm actually 100% sure I saw the movie first because I was just sitting here and thinking that I've never read this book that Brad Pitt and Edward Norton are not in my mind, which is one of those unfortunate th things when you see a movie first, is that
Yes.
then it's for you when you're reading the book, you have an image in your mind.
That was why that was my first question, was because it's very difficult for me to like read it without hearing the cadence of Edward Norton's delivery from the movie, because it is so close, because some of the dialogue is so close and some of the paragraphs are so close. It's very difficult for me not to picture Brad Pitt, Helena Bonham Carter. The score and the look of it and all of it is very closely tied to the film for me. The same as when we read Bridget Jones' Diary. Like I'm familiar with the movie, and I came to the book second, and the movie, like this movie, was also a good movie, a good adaptation. So it's very hard for me to, like, when we were reading that one, pull the text away from it. I made a real effort this time, but yeah, they're intertwined. Like I hear Edward Norton's delivery when I hear a lot of this.
Me too. But it was fortunate. I have not seen the movie in years at this point. And I did, so I had read this book a handful of times in high school, and then I actually had an adult revisitation of it, kind of recently, like in the past maybe 4 years. I picked this book back up just to read it again, and I think part of it was just the question in my mind of like, was this a good book? Like, I was in high school the last time I read it. The movie is so popular.
Yeah.
It's so endlessly quotable. The first rule of Fight Club is we don't talk about Fight Club is adapt, people use that all of the time and all sorts of things. So I think my question in going back was just like, is this a good book? And I do remember going back and being like, oh, this is a really good book. And it hits
Yeah.
different. And it hits different as an adult that has had a corporate job that is affected, I guess, by like consumerism and the things we need and the things we need to buy. And there is a more like adult, I think, understanding in this book. And to your point, this is a good, well-written book. And that I think gets lost in the popularity. It gets lost in the fact that it's a pop classic and that, Brad Pitt was at the height of his career, Edward Norton was at the height of his career when this movie came out,
It's
and made
also
it something that
difficult.
people like so much.
I mean, it's difficult to even doing research for this episode. It is difficult to find things where the author or the forum that's talking about it, or wherever I was like reading kind of about the book, like I said, we prepared for this, where the people talking about it just in the culture don't accidentally mix up the two. Like there's people who are, I was reading forums and comments and articles and think pieces. And there's places where over and over and over again, the author has clearly mixed up the book that he or she is talking about and the movie that they saw. They run together in, I think, a lot of people's minds, and partially for the closeness. We're going to talk about where they differ, though, also in a little bit. But I think another thing that I was worried about coming into it was because the online sort of, I don't even know if it's online, everywhere right now. In the last 5 years, the energy and the conversation around this book is all like just terminal online people kind of talking about red flags, and I don't know, its association with the alt-right. And if you talk to a guy and his favorite book is Fight Club, like you do not date him. There's a heavy negativity around enjoying this book or this film, I think, in a lot of circles.
Yeah, and I mean in today's culture, I can understand that in today's view of, let's be specific, today's view of the angry white man
Yeah.
is a different conversation than I think maybe what this book is addressing. And I mean, as we've discussed previously on this podcast, I mean, this book is dick lit. It is very like direct. It is very directed to men. It is about men. That's like what we're seeing in the book. We have one female character, one prevalent female character, right?
When I think of Dick Lit, it is Chuck Palahniuk. Or what we are sort of pejoratively calling chick lit and dick lit.
Right. But I think that what I mean, I think some of the politics he talks about, some of the things that our characters are angry about, don't necessarily only apply to men.
I also don't, I mean, I don't think it
Right? I
is.
mean, I this idea of consumerism and, this idea that we, as he kind of quotes and talks about, like, we're pushed into these jobs so we can buy things we don't need. I also have a job. Women
Yeah.
are also market, we're also marketed to. We have to buy all of these things to be a certain way or to have a certain status. I mean, that's something that applies to humanity. That's not something that solely applies to men. And right now there's lots of heavily charged conversations, and I'm in and for good reason. There is heavily charged
Well,
conversations when we're
you know why?
talking.
It's because Poliniak was, it's because he was right. It's because corporate culture, consumerism culture, the sort of complicity that we have in the machinations of corporations that we work for all lead to a dissatisfaction that pushes young men into often an unhealthy space where they end up falling for false idols and false gods. And then it happened, and we're all a lot more aware of it because of our online lives, that there are Jordan Petersons, so forth and so forth, these sort of holding pens of angry young men with bizarre sort of self-centered ideologies.
And we're, I mean, and we're, and we are seeing this come out in violence. We are seeing this come out in shootings, like in mass shootings, right? I mean,
Yeah.
so yes, to your right, to your point, I think he's giving voice to something that just exists.
I think the conversation around it misses the fact that the book does not advocate necessarily any of these things. It describes it. It's right. And it also existed before this book came out. And I don't want to give, I guess, too much air to this because I don't think it's super interesting to blame art for the, I don't know, the ancient behaviors that are embedded within us that have always existed, and to be like, oh, Fight Club's what made these alt-right manosphere people. It's not Fight Club. Like there are people in Christian churches who read the Bible, guys who are just sort of like, oh, it says right here that women have to like bow down to me. It says right here that I'm the most important person in my household, not my wife. There's a million, those people are like that no matter what. And whatever you put in front of them, they are going to draw the thing from it that appeals to the innate sense of sort of douchebaggery that
Agreed. So,
lives within
ladies,
them.
if you're out there and you're on a date and some guy's like, I really love the book Fight Club, dig a little deeper. What is he like about it? Does he just like Chuck Palahniuk? Was he just in
Yes.
high school when this book and movie came out and became a huge cultural zeitgeist? Like, maybe he also really appreciates the writing, but dig a little bit deeper. It might not be a red flag. You might have just ended up with somebody that reads. And if you're listening to this podcast, probably you like to read, and there's only so many of us out there these days.
If he tells you that he really likes Fight Club and he is a very big devotee of Jordan Peterson and that he has always enjoyed the podcast of Joe Rogan and his thoughts, and everybody's really giving Elon Musk too much crap at the moment, and that, you know, men's rights are a really important thing that we don't talk about enough and everything gets overshadowed by women's rights,
Collectively,
collectively,
that is a red flag.
red flag. Just Fight Club. That's just a,
Not sure
that's, I
that's a
don't even know if
flag.
that's a flag.
Tells me that he reads.
I think something that's interesting about this book is that this is a book for people who don't read. We were talking about how much we like the, how we think it is well written, and I do think it is well written. I have a couple little examples here of some of the language that I just think is great. The when he's talking about landing on one of the, he talks about flying a lot. He's talking about when the plane lands, and he mentions the staccato of. The staccato of 100 seat belts snapping open. And there's another part where he's talking about the support groups that he goes to, where he says that everywhere there's the squint of a 5-day headache. The staccato of 100 seat belts snapping open, when I read it, I hear the sound of being on a plane. I know exactly what that sound is. The squint of a 5-day headache is such a different way of describing the look of someone who is ill and who always feels bad. And I also know what that looks like. Like, I know it immediately. There's another one. He's thinking back on when he peed on the Blarney Stone. You leave the pub in a stream of men, walking through the beaded, wet car silence of streets where it's just rained. And I know what that sounds like. The last one that I put down here is when the elevator stops, the soup bowls stacked on the buffet cart stop rattling, and steam mushrooms up to the elevator ceiling as Tyler takes the lid off the soup tureen. All of these are just really well, like really great turns of phrase. The steam mushrooms up to the elevator ceiling, the soup bowls stacked on the buffet cart stop rattling. Like I hear the sound before that stopped. Like I know that look when you pull that silver cover off of a thing and that little plume comes up. I think all of that's just unique, interesting, well written and engaging. And this is still at the same time a book. Your friend who doesn't read books might read this book and love it. Not just read it. They might read it and love it and like read other
You know, it's
Polanyi
his
books.
writing is really direct and matter of fact, and so is the story. Our listeners know that
Yeah.
while I think that there are books that are worth paying 400 and 500 pages, but you and I appreciate a short, snappy read. And I mean, for me, he packs a lot. He packs a.
Girl, my issues, my
My
edition
edition
is
is
barely
two
over
hundred
200 pages.
yeah, is 204 pages. Nope, two
Love
okay,
it.
208,
It's great.
including the little afterword. His writing is direct. He's not pussyfooting around. The story moves. The story's not stalling anywhere. The story's not lagging anywhere. It comes right up. The end comes right up. We're not digging around. We're not left, like, we're not finishing the novel being like, well, why was this in here? Why, what did this have to do with anything? Maybe we didn't need that like diversion.
He writes the way he it is heightened, but it mimics the way someone might talk to you.
So I'm glad you said that.
It mimics the inconsistencies, the repetitions where people repeat themselves, like the way that you might tell someone a story or the way you might hear one told to you is the way he writes. And obviously he finagles it and finesses it to be readable. But that's the like tone and voice that in this one at least that really comes through.
So it's interesting that you said that, because an article that I was reading, it was in The Guardian. Somebody who interviewed Polanyi back in the early 2000s, said, if I were to hazard a guess as to why Chuck Palahniuk has so much money and such a devoted global fan base, I would say that it is mainly because he writes novels for the kind of people who don't normally read novels. So I thought it was funny that you said that, and
Yeah.
then Polanyi himself is quoted as saying, "I like to cut to the chase. I try to tell a story the way somebody, I try to tell a story the way someone would tell you a story in a bar, with the same kind of timing and pacing. I want that immediacy when I read a novel. I don't want all that other extraneous stuff, all those abstract chicken shit descriptions."
I mean, I like the way he says that, but I'll tell you, I've heard a lot of meandering
I'm
bullshit
sure.
stories in bars. I've heard some poor storytellers sitting at a bar with a couple of drinks in them.
Drunks are
But
not
I
known
get what he's
for
getting at.
short, snappy, to the point stories.
They're not known for their minimalist style and their punchy timing.
But his point, I think, that in a social setting, we would just get through a story, whereas sometimes in
Yeah.
novel, and listen, like, again, I like to read 400 or 500 pages. I mean, okay, we just read The Secret History, 500 pages. Some of that meandered. Some of that could have been cut out. But I still enjoyed the
Yeah.
novel. So I'm not saying that there isn't a place for that, but that is not his writing. And I do think that that is what appeals to people that aren't big readers.
I think that accessibility also maybe contributes to why this book is still talked about, whether negatively or positively, is that, like it or not, like tons and tons of people have read it
Yeah.
because it is readable. And, you know, it's readable. He still elevates his language, I think, and makes it engaging, makes it poppy, makes it literary. And I don't know, I think maybe some more people could take the cue that you should read, write the kind of books that some guy who, I don't know, fixes buses might like to read. Not to particularly pick on bus mechanics, but I pick it because
Oh,
Polanyi, I
nice.
think, was a bus mechanic for a little while.
And something, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, there are two things in particular about Fight Club, though, that I've noticed are always true. One is that anyone who is doing a podcast like this one, or writing an article, or a review, or a think piece, feels compelled, almost unstoppably, to do a
A
riff on the
hundred
rules of Fight Club.
percent.
The first rule of podcasting is you don't talk about like that
The
kind of
article
thing,
that
or
I
the
was just the article I was just reading quotes from, the headline is a riff on the first rule of Fight Club.
every Reddit post, every opinion piece, every review, every little thing I came across, people do it. Every podcast about the movie, people do it. The second thing is that I feel like it's almost like a rite of passage. Like I feel compelled like everybody else, but I think the number one thing everybody says about it is that everyone besides them misses the point, which I think is an interesting thing about a book, is that everyone believes they understand it, and everyone believes that every single other person who talks about it doesn't understand it. Like, there's a ton of think pieces that are like, what all of these alt-right dinguses get wrong about, like, the real meaning of Fight Club. And there's other people who are like, the real meaning of Fight Club is this. And the people for like believing that everyone else is wrong about Fight Club is one of the hallmarks of Fight Club.
I think that's, yeah, that's true. This is a
Like
conversation that
believing that
I've,
everyone else
yes,
missed
that
the
I've had, is that no
satire.
one, oh, I think, you know, I think people just don't, don't understand it. And it's like, well, I think a lot of people under, I think a lot of people understand it. I mean, for what it's worth, it's not a super complex novel in my, I mean, in my opinion, I guess. That's not a knock on it. I just think he's fairly straightforward with what he's coming out with.
But there's something interesting about the fact that everyone thinks they have the take on it, and that everyone else who talks about it is missing their take, which I don't know, what does it say? It says that it is deeply personal to everyone who reads it. Like they feel almost dogmatic about it.
I guess so, yeah.
Because I think that the reason one of the reasons I think that everyone has a slightly different take on it about what the point is that the point is super muddled. Like I'm not sure that the book knows. I don't think it lands on a point, is my two cents there. I think the point is a little bit muddled. I think it can be lost. I think it is lost in the sheer volume of ideas that Poliniak rams at you in this very engaging, repetitive, catchy language. Like you're just flooded with things.
Yes, and I mean this is a big part of it, but I mean this is also something that's coming out of the mind of somebody who's deeply mentally disturbed. Our narrator, right? Right? I mean you see, do you see what I'm saying? Like
I mean, yes, but that is a completely valid take that, like, this is a book that is pointing out, like, the shallowness of material culture, the dangers of what can happen, like, gives you, but whatever, it's in the text, it's not wrong. But I don't know, the emptiness of corporate culture is also there within the text. That's not wrong either. The childishness and the emptiness of, like, mischief and anarchy as a solution to your problems as an adult is also there within the text. The absentee father playing a damaging role in the men of the country overall, that men are letting down men over and over and over again, and men continue to let down men, and then those men go on to just let themselves and other people down, also creating this pattern within the text, and also a completely valid read on the book. The I don't know. I read Palahniuk, Polanyi himself, saying that it was a romance, and I feel like at this point he's just kind of trying to find things to say about it, because I don't feel like that one's. It's a stretch, but
Well,
fine, it's there. The Tyler narrator romance and the three-way sort of love triangle with
I'll read you a
Marla,
quote.
Tyler, and the narrator. I think it's thin. Hit
This is
me.
towards the end of the book. I know why Tyler had occurred. Tyler loved Marla. From the first night I met her, Tyler, or some part of me, had needed a way to be with Marla. Just saying. Just saying.
Yeah, I know.
But
No.
it.
I know that it's in there, and that we are told it in exactly that many words.
But again, Is that where Tyler comes from? Because while Tyler is involved with Marla, Tyler's also out doing a bunch of other mayhem and anarchy.
No, that's why I think it's thin, but it is told to us. We're not shown it anywhere, but it is told to us. The class warfare in this, if you were to take that, is a completely legitimate read on the book, that it is about the underclass, like just wanting to take back a world, even if it's through meaningless acts of self-destruction and like community destruction, to just fight back and like work toward the redistribution of wealth. All of these are completely valid, but I think there's just so much of this in the book that that's part of the reason that everyone's little personal take on it feels personal to them and feels correct to them, and that everyone else's read on it feels wrong to a lot of readers.
People are pulling out what speaks to them. And there's a lot.
And
Yeah.
there's a lot
People
in
are
here.
pulling out what it is that is the most meaningful to them out of all of this stuff. Because I mean, yeah, like you said, I don't know that there's meant to just be one single point. The point of this novel is not that is not solely that it's a romance. I mean, that's in there, I guess, with Marla, kind of.
I mean, that's the one that I think is the weakest, but still, the author speaks to it.
It's
It
in there. There's a
does.
love
It is a
triangle in
love
there.
triangle. I mean,
Marla's there for him in the end. She's there for him through the whole book, but I mean, she's there for him in the end. He has some appreciation of her, towards the end.
And the book is often billed as a satire. I think that's
I
accurate, in
I
my
think
opinion.
so.
You
Yes.
think so?
I think it's meant to be. I think it's meant to be over the top, over the top and chaotic. And I think that's, yeah, I think that's on purpose.
I think the take, I mean, I think the reading of it as a satire is the strongest around work, right? Around the like one of the complaints of the narrator, one of the ongoing complaints about Tyler is just the emptiness of their jobs and the sort of like bullshit dead end work that they're doing, mainly Tyler. But I guess also when our narrator starts working at the Pressman Hotel and so forth, that these are empty and meaningless and they're dead end and they're not going anywhere, and like it's not what we were sold as like a life. And then as Tyler gains power and gets a following, he brings all these space monkeys to his house and puts them to work doing meaningless
And they all
dog
just
shit little
fall in
jobs.
line into it under another man.
Your one
You know what
job
I
is to
mean?
clean the toilet. Yes, your one job is to clean out the bowl over and over again. You do one thing and you do it perfectly and you do it over and over again. And that's the same thing that they were escaping or
And you know,
complaining
we
about in
see
the
these
first
little
place.
this is a hilarious, okay, this is kind of a hilarious example, but I mean we do have these little we as humans, I mean, we do have these little ways of reclaiming something from our meaningless, BS jobs or whatever it is. And one of those things is pooping on the clock. People who purposely want to just take their time to be
Yeah,
like, I go to
that's
work, I do my bowel movement on the clock because I want to be paid for it, and that's a way I will take some of my time back, right? And
you know, you could read this entire book as an
these guys
extremely
are,
violent heightening
yeah,
these
these guys
of that
are
particular
peeing in
act.
soup, you know what I mean? But I think that's the satire, is because we do have, I mean, because people do feel this way. People do have these little angers and these little anarchies and these little ways of reclaiming something, or trying to put a little kink in the system in a way that maybe just makes you feel better. These are things that exist, for a lot of people.
Do you want to go into our categories and do the Bechdel test?
I wanted to bring up there's a couple of things I want to talk about first. One of them is that just something I wanted to point out. This is another book that starts at the end.
Oh, that's true.
So, like, Little Fires Everywhere, The Secret History. We've seen this. I mean, that's just I mean, obviously, it's just a writing mechanism. I mean, it's not something special, but it's come up a few times in our podcast. So again, this is something that this is again just like a novel that starts at the end. We
It's
start
inverted.
with him on top of the building with a gun in his mouth, with Tyler having a gun in his mouth. and we work backwards again. So I just wanted to kind of point that out. When he's talking about, and then just like, there's just two other little notes I made, nothing big. So when he's talking about his apartment being blown up and he's going through and he's just like listing all of his like possessions, all of his, belongings. We all have the same Rizlampahar paper lamps made from wire and environmentally friendly unbleached paper, minor confetti. All that sitting in the bathroom, the Alley cutlery service, stainless steel, dishwasher safe, the Vild hall clock made of galvanized steel. Oh, I had to have that. My favorite is the yin yang table for no reason. But my note on that, and again, just because we've kind of done this little series kind of around, not around, well, I guess sort of around Bret Easton Ellis, but that to me was just sort of like the anti Bret Easton Ellis, because he loves to list. He loves to list designers and belongings and that kind of thing, and this guy's just
Yeah.
blown all of his up. So my note for that was just like, it's like the anti-Bret Easton Ellis.
I like that. It's like it's a funnier riff on the like. Clearly, Bret Easton Ellis adores name brands and
Right.
adores talking about them and likes having descriptions of those things. And this is done purely
Exactly.
in disdain. Like it's absolute disdain for these name brand things and these designer
His life
affectations
was
and little
just too
bits of
complete,
furniture.
was just too perfect and complete, so he had to go in and blow it all up.
I think that's also like a piece of like the satire to it is that like he's bored.
So he goes in and creates all of this like anarchy. Yeah, he's just bored. He has a boring job. He's
Yeah.
gotten all of this stuff. He has this boring apartment that he spent filling with things.
And I don't mean to underplay that because, like, I do think the like, I think the like dis being disaffected by the modern condition is actually a legitimate thing that everyone experiences, whether they want to admit it or not, or whether they think that Fight Club, is overstating it or whatever their opinion is. That like, but it is just that he's bored. Like, we keep hearing about the that his job as a recall coordinator makes him complicit in the like the death of many, many people, the knowing that these people will die, that they will have birth defects of their children will have birth defects, that they will get cancer, and that they don't do recalls because it's not cost effective. But that isn't why he's upset. He's
Agreed.
bored. Like that's like he even has a line, which I mean, like it's kind of like the explaining sort of the silly thing that caused all this, where he's telling Marla, he says, "I was tired and crazy and rushed, and every time I boarded a plane, I wanted the plane to crash. I envied people dying of cancer. I hated my life. I was tired and bored with my job and my furniture, and I couldn't see any way to change things, only end them." It's both the sort of satirical indictment, I guess, of what all of these buffoons end up doing running around this town, creating mayhem, as they call it, and creating boring jobs for themselves. Men who are not creative enough to see beyond wanting change, right? I don't like this and I want to
And then
change it.
without being able to like take the action and the power to like, well, like, right, I don't like this and I want to change it. But then you have to think about like, well, to what? How
To
am I
what?
going to
There is no
change it, and
answer to
what
that.
am I
To
going to
what?
change
Yeah.
it to?
There's a part where Tyler's talking about Project Mayhem, and he says it's going to save the world by forcing humanity to go dormant or into remission long enough for the Earth to recover, which sounds like a very left-wing, I don't know, save the Earth kind of thing you would expect, like lots of people to, like, that's cool. But then he says, you justify anarchy, you figure it out, which is like, oh, you just need to find a way
Right.
to justify doing these things, which he follows with. Yeah, that's it. He's like, you justify anarchy, you figure it out. Like it's always make something better of the world. I'm making finger quotes as I say that, but it's non-specific. Like they never explain what the better world is, except this vague, like you wear leather clothes and
Right. You're
hunt. Go, you could
going
go
to be
fucking hunting
hunting elk
now.
around Rockefeller Center is like a, it was one of the things, right? Like because the
This is 1996.
Right,
You could
because
go
like there are,
hunting today.
because you've
You go
destroyed
hunting
humanity.
the.
But like, if you destroy humanity, then like the humans left are going to have to figure out how to build, rebuild humanity. That's what literally every single movie, TV show, and book about humanity being destroyed and some people being left behind is about, is like banding back together to a community and rebuilding
Yeah.
civilization. We need some of this stuff.
It's also though it's not even a goal that is gone. It's not like they want to bring back the dodo or they wish I don't know, medieval values still existed. They could just go hunting in whatever
You could
state they
just go
live
live
in.
off the
They could just
grid.
go hunt.
People
That's
do it.
yeah, no, totally doable. It's a thing that
Canada,
they could
Alaska, these
easily
places
go
have lots
do.
of space, and like you could just go live off the grid somewhere and be out of all of these things and be out of all of
No,
this commercialism and all of these things that you don't like. But that's a really, I really like the way you said is like these are people who want change and they're not creative enough to like actually make it happen. So right, like
yeah, I couldn't see any way to
so
change
they come
things,
to the Paper
only
Street
end
Soap
them.
Company, where like on one hand of things, it's funny that you're stealing fat. It's funny that you're stealing fat that has been like sucked out of rich people and then putting into soap and selling their own
Yeah.
fat asses back to them at a premium. That is funny.
That's another one of those ideas, though, that you could be forgiven for being like, that's the point, is the like the what you know, what like image culture has us doing to ourselves, and be completely justified in being like, that's the
Right.
point of the book.
But I mean, yes, like if I were to, I'm going to quit my boring corporate job and I'm going to go make soap.
No, I think that's like leans into like what makes this satirical is that like that it is just boredom. They don't have a good reason, and they're also not chasing something that doesn't exist. They could go do the thing they want to do, like
Yes, and kind of
tomorrow.
leave.
It's
Go into the woods, have your fight club, go hunting.
all it's
Yeah.
totally achievable. And I think it's also interesting that like that they can't do it. Like to cut to the very end when like the people are whispering to him in the psych ward, like, we have plans, the plan is still going. I'm sorry, you didn't do it yet?
Right.
It's
How
still
come
in the
it's,
planning
why isn't this
stage?
done?
Like, you
Yeah.
fools.
You guys were gonna blow up this building and like ruin the whole city and like you don't?
No, they don't actually know how to make dynamite. They can't make
Right.
it work. It doesn't work. They're failures.
Right.
Like they're still trying to do it. Like at the end, and it's still not, it's just pranks around a city. It's not any kind of great change. It's just an empty, it's a bunch of empty dumb shits just
Bored
bored.
and wanting to create anarchy.
Yeah.
Also, there's a handful of Valley of the Dolls references in this book. He keeps
I
bringing it up as
noted
like
those.
when they're talking about like the animal control.
He does it twice. You get it in two different references. You get it in the like the Seminoles and all of that, the Valley of the Dolls play set.
The
And then they have
Valley
the
of the
tie into the
Dogs
Valley of
with
the Dogs play set with the metaphor of
yep.
abandoned once loved things.
And I enjoyed that. That made me happy. A callback to one of our first podcast novels.
I like it because it also means we're right
It is a
that
popular
that is a
classic.
popular
This is
classic.
not the first time it has been referenced in another
Yeah.
book that we have done.
No, I it was in
It was in Slaughterhouse
Slaughterhouse-Five
Five
as well,
and something
and
else
I
we
like
read.
that it.
Also, there was a callback.
It was.
Maybe it was a, no, I think it was just Seminoles. I can never hear
Oh, maybe
Seminoles
it was
that I
the.
don't think of Valley of the
Oh
Dolls.
no, you're. It was the old timey drugs in
Yeah,
some book we read that we were
it
talking
was
about,
yeah,
the old timey
Seminoles.
Valley of the Dolls drugs, yeah.
I really enjoy, we've been talking about the writing. The rep in and this actually reminded, I mean, I could save this for you know who you remind me of, but I actually just made this connection now. The repetition throughout this book reminds me of Slaughterhouse Five.
Yes.
So we see it in, we see it in like the Reader's Digest, I am Joe's raging bile duct. Yeah, I'm Joe's faulty pancreas.
Am Jack's
Yes,
complete
I like
lack of
that one.
surprise.
There's the repetition we see, like in the beginning of the novel, he's crying into Big Bob's shirt and it leaves like his like the imprint of his crying face. And then like one of the first Fight Club scenes, he leaves like a bloody he has like a bloody face print on the floor, after he takes a beating. Like that was
Oh,
one of
yeah.
the repetitions. And then later in the book, as things are really heating up, like Tyler's words are my words, Tyler's hands are my hands. These are Tyler's words coming out of my mouth. I used to be such a nice person. Like that starts getting repeated. Something that I think is fun in going back and reading this is kind of how apparent it is that he and Tyler are the same person. I mean, it's not the first time you read it.
I was trying to make an effort to pretend I was reading this without knowing that Tyler Durden and our narrator, by the way, spoilers for a 25, over 25-year-old book and film. I was trying to read it as though, as though it was clean and I didn't know that. Because when I saw the movie, it blew my mind. I did not see it coming.
Right.
But in the movie, we have two separate actors and the scenes are structured in such a way that while there are lots of really fun Easter eggs on a second viewing where you can see it once you know, the mystery is held so much farther at bay just by the fact that there's Edward Norton and Brad Pitt in the film. There's so many clues to it in the
There are
book,
so many clues
but.
to it in the book, and like I said, I am fairly certain at this point that I did see the movie first, so I've never had the opportunity to read it without knowing that, which is unfortunate.
But I can also see that, because Tyler's not introduced with a lot of depth, and it's not, there's not a lot of background or, logic to how they end up together. I mean, I know we're told what it is. He went on vacation and met Tyler on a nude beach, and then he lives in the same town, and he invites him to live with him. But so much of the book is just, you're dropped into the middle of a thought, middle of a scene, that you kind of don't have the time to question that. I was thinking that that might be I don't know if I would have gotten
I
it
don't th I think if
if I
you
read
I
it
think if
without
you
knowing it.
read this book, it would be a surprise. But then when you go back, it's there.
Oh, it's yeah, it's everywhere.
When Tyler and Marla like have sex for the first like when they start like having sex or whatever, and our narrator is upset about it, like there's a page. I'm starting to wonder if Tyler and Marla are the same person. Tyler and Marla are never in the same room. I never see them together. Further down, if Tyler's around, Marla ignores him. And then the number of times that like Marla leaves and Tyler just like, and he says it like, and Tyler just appears, essentially.
He gives us little comparison points for all of that, though, that distract us from the
But because
weirdness.
if you're reading that for the first time, you're thinking like Tyler was just lurking around and like left, do you know what I mean? Like he was just lurking around and like, oh, now I'm back because she's
Yeah.
gone, and he's like avoid, he's avoiding her or whatever. But if you when you go back and read it and knowing it's very straightforward. It is very, I think, kind of like in your face, which feels like his, which I think is also a nod to to how well this book is written. That you're completely surprised at the end of it, and then
I
it's like
wouldn't
when
have.
you go back and read it, it's like, oh, it's right there. You know?
I mean, I think another nod to the creativity and the way it's crafted is that that is such a stupid concept, but it works.
It does.
It's just a dumb, if you were to tell your, I don't know, freshman year creative writing professor that you're like, eh, but you're gonna think they're two different people, but they're the same guy, he or she would be like, that's, don't, no.
Right.
There, don't do that. That's dumb. It's outlandish. To have your central premise of a novel be that your main character has a split personality, it's just ridiculous. But it works. It works. I buy it. I still think it's an interesting book, and it's layered in there in such a way that I think is clever. And I think it's funny that it is such an outlandish concept. You don't see it repeated. I don't. They mention they have to name check two movies to even tell you, the reader, kind of what the concept is. It's like Psycho. Marla has the line where she's like, oh, Anthony Perkins' character in Psycho
Right.
thought he was his own mother. And then later, when he's in the support group explaining it, he's like, has anyone seen the
Yeah.
movie Sybil? which I don't know if you've ever seen Sybil. Sally Fields was in it, but she has multiple personalities. I think she got an Oscar for it.
Yeah, it's been a really long time, but I saw it at some point when I was young,
Like they
yeah.
have to name check two films to make sure that you, the reader, understand that like it's this
What's
concept.
happening? Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do Bechdel
Let's do the Bechdel test.
because I want to talk about Marla.
To absolutely fails. So in another way
Oh, yeah.
that it's like Slaughterhouse-Five is that it just solidly fails the Bechdel test.
Absolutely does not
I even went
pass.
back to look like in the support group scenes. Like I went back to be like, well, like okay, so there's like little Chloe, but like no, Chloe doesn't have a conversation with anybody. Her sister comes to tell the group that Chloe dies. And I was even like, I was like, well, maybe like is Marla in the room? Does Marla say anything about that? Like, no.
The only I named the there's Chloe, Marla, the waitress or the sous chef or whatever from the like perfume scene.
Right, yeah, there's a female in that scene, but I think everyone else in the room is male. She
The
doesn't talk to the wife. She doesn't talk to the
wife of
hostess.
the no, the wife of the recycling liaison who gets killed at the murder dinner party.
But she doesn't.
No, I'm just saying those are the only
Those are the
women in
only
the book,
women in the book, even in general. Yeah, and like they're not.
and two of them don't have names.
Right. One of them's just a wife, just a sous chef.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I guess one of them doesn't have a name. The woman, I can't remember what it is, but the woman at the perfume scene has, they name her. That's how you know she's a woman, but
But I mean, I think she's just the hostess. Oh, she might get named. Her
no,
husband names her.
in the kitchen crew, I
Oh, I
mean.
see. Oh, yes. I sorry. Yes.
There's Tyler, another waiter, a dishwasher, and then like the cook is a lady. She has a couple of lines.
She has
She
a
gets to
couple of lines
speak,
and
but
is kind of
like,
just that
yeah.
she's referred to as a she.
She does get a name. I'm just saying she doesn't talk to another. No, it doesn't pass.
It doesn't pass. But we do have a really in but I mean we do have a very interesting female character in Marla.
We have an interesting female character in Marla, and I think there's a take on this book that, like, at one point Tyler is talking to our narrator, and he says something about, like, we're a generation of men raised by women, and I don't think another woman is what we need. And then there's this complete lack of like female characters in the book outside of like Marla as our other character. But that looks a lot like misogyny, sounds a lot like misogyny. And usually, if something looks and sounds like a duck, it's a duck. But the Tyler's suggestion that another woman is not what we need, I think, is like proven completely false on purpose by the text, because these dudes complain about their father. They complain about their bosses, who are all men. All of the conflicts, all of the people that they murder, all of the people that they're upset with, all of the people that are like actually like drag, are all guys. There are no women, and there are no women for them to complain about. And the only thing we're kind of told that either of them want is Marla. Tyler wants Marla. The only thing they want is a woman.
Pretty much, yeah.
Like we're told anyhow that Tyler wants Marla, and our main character does in fact like Marla, which is a distinction between the book and the film that I think is done better by the book. In the movie, at the end, where he's sort of like, I realize I've come to like you. Watching the rest of the movie, you're just sort of like, when did that happen? Because there's absolutely no point in
No,
this
we
when you like Marla.
you see it in the book more.
You see them spend time
They're
together. You
spending
see him go
time
out of his way to
together.
be kind. You see her grow on him and him go out of his way to be kind to her and be caring for her feelings and her emotions when he goes over to do the breast exam. That's the point where he starts being nice to Marla, and you see that like it's an actual developing relationship between the two of them. The movie does what the book does with Tyler and Marla and just tells us like, ah, I like you. Like, oh, you do? That wasn't an
Yeah.
inherent part of this film, but
Yeah.
okay.
That's fair.
But all the conflicts and problems are between men, which I guess supports like the satire of the work, is that there aren't any women. And every problem is a male on male problem. developed by men and happening to men and complained about by men and reacted to poorly by men.
So this is a novel about how the patriarchy is also not that awesome for men.
I mean, I do think that it is legitimately a book that kind of pokes fun at the patriarchy. Like I know
Yeah.
that like Poloniex mentioned several times that like there's lots of books that kind of talk about like social models for women, and I noticed that there weren't any for men, and so I wanted to write one about that. And you know, because he's Chuck Palahniuk, he wrote one about like what happens when there aren't any kind of like models for men to be together in a way that isn't any way productive. But no, I mean, I think that's right. I think the book is about the self-defeating nature of the patriarchy. I don't know if patriarchy was a term that we used the same way in 1996, but that is, I think, actually kind of the central joke of the book, if
Yeah.
you will.
Yeah, and that is interesting that like your that is interesting your point, like we could look at this as misogyny, and like you know, we on our the beginning of our podcast we were talking about some of the conversation, some of the present day conversation around Fight Club. But it is interesting to like take that step back and look at it and like, yeah, all the problems in this book are between men, created by men, and if you know, and affecting men. There's kind of one bright spot for our characters, and it is Marla.
At the end of the book, the only person that he wants to talk to
Is
is
Marla.
Marla. Like the book ends with him desperately wanting to hear a woman, which is not to say that Tyler is not misogynistic. He is. And it is not to say that there are not misogynistic characters and stuff within the book. There are. But I think the book overall is deliberately focused on men and kind of how dumb that is. And I think it's funny that it ends with. Because his doctor is a man, I think. Like the other
Yeah.
guys who work at the psychiatric ward who keep being like, we're still working on the plan, buddy. This plan that isn't coming to any kind of fruition.
Right.
And he tells us, he's like, the only person I wish would call me who can't is Marla. And I wouldn't hang up and I would ask her to tell me every little thing, tell me everything that's going on. Like he wants a female voice desperately, and that's how we end.
Let's do 1 stars.
You may not be shocked to know that the perhaps the predominant one is that this book is ugly, mean, twisted, and far too dark. It is supposed to be a satire that does a bad job of conveying that, that it is dark and amoralistic with no intellectual heft to justify that darkness or immorality. Things that are like sub bullets of this is that Tyler is a domestic terrorist. The viewpoint is childish and sophomoric, leading to dumb macho violence, which I suppose all checks out.
I can't. I mean, we've just had conversations about how everyone feels that everyone feels that they know the true meaning. Lots of people feel that they know the true meaning of this book, right? And what we've talked about is like, well, there's a lot of ideas in this book, and people are picking out what is meaning. People who like it are picking out what is meaningful to them and what they're seeing in this book. And so some other people are reading this book and seeing it. And seeing it in a different way. And Tyler is a domestic terrorist. That's not untrue. He's blowing up,
That's
he's blowing
not
up,
untrue at
he's
all.
blowing up buildings. He's encouraging them to he's encouraging them to
And
start fights with people and beat people up and kill people.
some of the language is also, it's like, it is set on disturbing, right? Like, that's what this sentence is meant to be ugly and viscerally kind of uncomfortable about, like, the guy biting his own tongue in half, things like that. And if you don't like that, this book isn't for you. That the violence is childish and sophomoric and dumb macho violence. This guy's bored and he starts a fight club so that like these guys can beat up on each other to feel something. I can see how that's easily dismissed, but like I think the fight club works the same way that like a hunger strike works. Like it is the like a hunger strike only hurts the person who is doing it, really, but it is a defiant act that shows that you are able to control one thing about yourself in an uncontrollable situation. It is a desperate way of taking some sort of power back, and that's why people do it. That's why it works when it works, I suppose. It's a recapturing of the only thing you can control and trying to use it as a means of power in a situation where you are helpless. And I think that's what the fight club part of it is, right? Like I feel this way about my job and my life and my stupid couch and the like sort of promises of grown-up life that I thought were really heavily, heavily sold to me and everything everyone told me. And it's just this empty thing now where like I have to like, get haircuts all the time and like buy stuff and like worry about ads. And I think the fighting is that like I'm doing something terrible to myself that like I am consensually entering into with another person who is consensually entering into it. And this is our, we're doing it to us, right?
Yeah.
Is that a reach?
No.
That's what it is, right? That's what the like.
I think, I mean, listen, I think so, but that's our interpretation of it.
Like that's the part of the book that works. And then when they move into Project Mayhem is when it becomes stupid. And our narrator thinks it's stupid, like the where it becomes dumb. But like the initial part is like, do you remember like 8 years ago
No, I
when
mean,
everyone
and
was doing those tough mutter competitions?
yes.
Like you work in an office all day, but on the weekends you go to a field and you climb over a wall and you crawl through mud and you run a 15K while someone throws bricks at your ankles, and then you, I don't know, box, whatever those things were.
Yeah, no,
Like that
I'm
was.
because the thing with the
That's
Fight
a more
Club
above
too
line
is it
version of
is
doing the same thing, right? To feel something
right. Because the thing
close.
with Fight Club is like people are you're knowingly entering into this. It's volunteer. I'm volunteering. I want to sign up and fight somebody knowing I might lose. Right?
Yeah. Yes,
And
I'm
that's
choosing to feel this and do
yeah,
this.
and I think that's fine. And then yes, as we get into Project Mayhem and these other things, these are affecting other people.
It perverts the original idea because Project Mayhem impacts the innocent, and like while there's a little bit of it directed toward like a little bit of class warfare, there is. They also go to a Denny's at one point where like the narrator has to tell them like don't clean food. He's like, oh, the lady shouldn't order the clam chowder then, and like Denny's ain't serving the rich. It is not
Right.
known as the like dining hotspot of the 1%. Like that's the average schmo is eating. I'm eating at Denny's.
Right. People who don't have a lot of money and are also working these dead-end jobs and are unhappy with their lives and struggling to pay for things they actually legitimately do need are also eating at Denny's.
Yeah, that's the like meal out for like someone who like works for a living, like for real, and you're these idiots are like fucking up their grand slam.
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
I think the Grand Slam is at Denny's. I don't have one near me, so I've not eaten at one in a long time.
I've eaten it at Denny's. That's what I'm telling you. I eat at Denny's. Grand Slam's at Denny's. That's a Denny's thing. Second most popular is that the writing style is unbearable and unreadable. The repetition, the punctuation, the sentence structure. And as you and I talked about a minute ago, it reminds us of Kurt Vonnegut. Like it's pulled, the repetition is pulled from like what, like the Greek chorus. It has like a classical like
Yeah.
reference point to it.
That just.
Vonnegut does it in all of his books, I think, but most famously, of course, Slaughterhouse-Five.
That's just a. Per I mean, that to me is just a matter of personal preference, I guess. I mean, someone else, I guess, is not enjoying this style of writing. I disagree with that, but I mean.
I mean, it's also brilliant for the longevity of the book. It's so quotable and memorable because of those things.
I don't like stream of consciousness writing. That to me is like it's difficult for me to read, and I don't get super into something that is written that way. It is not that I think that is bad writing. I just don't
I
like
don't
it.
understand how they edit it.
I struggle to wrap my brain around it, and I struggle to stay like in a story, and I struggle to stay with the writing when it's just the stream of consciousness. Is not something I, it's just not something I enjoy. So I feel like if you don't, you can just not like somebody's writing style and not want to read it. I mean, again, I think that's, I don't, you and I don't agree with that. I like the way this book is written.
I think it is legitimately good. I think it is legitimately creative. And I think it is striking. And I think it serves the longevity of this book, the quotability of this book. And I think that's a very difficult thing to do while also making a book that is accessible to people who like feel outside of book culture or don't like to read or weren't raised with an appreciation for it, to like be able to bring them in while still also writing well. I think that's very difficult.
Agreed.
Third one, controversial. The movie was better. I loved the movie. I got the book because I loved the movie so much, and this book is crap, but I love the movie. It's so much better.
You love the movie because it has Edward Norton and Brad Pitt, and it is just legitimately a good movie.
It is. I mean, I think the movie, I have a couple problems with the book, and I think that the movie fixes the things that I see as problems with the book. So this is a problem that I have with all of Polanyi's books that I've ever read, is that there are just these nonsensical things in them. The problem with them being nonsensical is that they are knowable of what they actually should be. What I mean is that, there's lots of them. There's one on like the second page where he's like, you know that saying, how you always kill the ones you love? That's not a saying. There's a saying, you always hurt the ones you love, but you always kill the ones you love, not a saying. And everyone knows it's not a saying because it's a saying. And in the movie, they fix it. They say, you always hurt the one you love. They say it right. I don't know why it's wrong. I don't know why the cigarette burns, which are knowably wrong, are in there. I don't know why in chapter six, our narrator is running the slideshow for a demo for Microsoft because he's a recall campaign coordinator. They aren't
Actually, I
doing.
also wondered why it was for Microsoft.
There's all. Every one of his books have these ridiculous, but knowably ridiculous. Like, you know that they're incorrect. It's not like if he were to tell us, like, when he's telling us that, like, if you mix fucking whatever, potassium nitrate and phosphorus and sawdust and cat litter together to make dynamite, I don't, maybe you can lie about something like that. And as a reader, I don't know. If you were to tell me that on the International Space Station, they have to use the bathroom upside down because of the way the toilets are, they always have to be at an upside down angle to make, I don't know that, maybe. He always does it with things that are completely knowable. There's a point in the book where they light birthday candles with the push-in cigarette lighter of a car. You were alive when those were a thing.
Can't light a candle. You can't light a
No,
candle with that. That's not how
no.
that
And
works.
it's a knowable thing that you can't do that. There's a part in the book where the narrator is like, Tyler, I have to wash my pants. We have to make soap. We have to make soap so I can wash my pants. You don't have to make soap to do that. You can go buy soap. And on the same page, they send Marla to the store to buy lye flakes so they can make soap.
She could have just bought the soap.
Yes. The movie fixes these things. In the movie, they're just making soap because that's what we're doing tonight. That's what S Tyler does for a job. And that works fine. There's no reason for it to be wrong in the book. Just
So
like.
you agree with this? You agree with this one star poster? Do you think the movie is better than the book?
I guess I think of it like Bridget Jones' Diary. There are parts of the movie Bridget Jones' Diary that I think resolve things that are messy in the book. I think when we talked about Bridget Jones' Diary, I mentioned that in the book, one of the things that I really liked that stood out to me was that we very early on we get this sense of Bridget standing up for herself against Daniel on a date that doesn't go right. Like, we hear from, like, she's not a flighty twit. She is someone who actually has self-respect and who stands up for certain things and wants something, and that is missing from the movie. Much like the Marla relationship here is better in the book and is missing from the movie. There are a lot of things in Bridget Jones' Diary, the movie, though, that just make the story work better for a movie. Like, the ending is a better resolution, the plot line of the love triangle is better, all leaving out all the stuff about how British Star 69 works, all better to not be in the movie. Is one better than the other? I don't think the ending of this book is very good. I think the ending of the movie is better. The ending of the movie actually resolves Tyler as a character. We see him get shot in the head and die. In the ending of this book, Marla and everyone from the support groups magically appears on the roof. If they come, Marla gets everyone from the support groups together and they go to save the narrator and they come up to the tallest
Yeah,
building in
I
the
had
world through all the
forgotten.
space monkeys, and then they're just there saying, "We love you." It's dog shit. It's a dog shit ending.
I had also like forgotten that and read it and was like, this is the end of this book?
No, yeah, the end,
Like,
I think
And when I read this a couple years ago, it also shocked me then too about being like, but everything in this has been so good and like anarchical, and now, and now there's this. I was also like disappointed by
I
that.
think like the last 20 pages of this book are bad, and I think my
The movie ending is better.
a lot of these things that it just resolves that are just cleaner, that like the Marla is destitute, eating Meals on Wheels for dead people. She lives in a slummy little rent-a-room motel, and she's got a collagen trust fund because her mom's sucking fat out of herself and mailing it to her, and she's storing it in their freezer. That's stupid. It doesn't make sense. She doesn't have any money. She's dirt poor. She's going to get filler. In the movie, they just cut right to the medical waste facility. We just steal fat from the liposuction clinic. It makes more sense. It's funnier. It's a better point. It goes better with the like themes of the book and the film. The movie resolves a lot of these problems, I think. And these are problems that exist. I've read, I don't know, four or five of his books. These problems exist in every one of his books. In Choke, for example, there's a thing where he's like on every flight going around the country, there's people just waiting in the airline bathrooms to have sex. It's a whole thing. And it's just knowable that that's not true. If you've ever been on an airplane, 100% knowable that's not a thing. And it's like a major plot point. And he's just always got these like fantastical, like clearly bullshit things in his book, like Marla's collecting collagen. I don't know. Why is that in there?
Why, yeah, that's a good point.
So I don't know if I think the movie is better. I don't know if I don't even necessarily like to think about it in that way. I like the book. I like the movie. It's not important to me that one defeat the other one in some way. But the movie does wrap up a lot of the loose ends that the book, I think, leaves messy. I think in the book, kind of part of the point is like, what's the point of Project Mayhem? Like, they're going to blow up this building and it'll fall on a museum and then that's the end of history. That's also dumb. I think that is sort of the point.
Yeah.
I think in the movie, they do a disservice by making Tyler Durden a little bit more of a Robin Hood. I'm going to blow up all these credit card buildings and we set the debt record back to zero and we free people from debt. I think that problematically is like a little bit too much of a good guy thing.
Yeah, because he's not a good guy.
No, and I think the movie gets that wrong. But otherwise, I think the ending is better. I think Tyler's resolved better as a character. I think he's killed and it's a little bit more definitive. I think the fact that Marla is there in the building is like done in a more elegant way. All of that, I think, is better.
Because more, I mean, because more ideas come across in writing.
Well, and the like absolutely the absolute pointlessness of the entire thing is a little bit more
More of the
apparent
darkness
in the
and
book.
stuff
Yeah.
is,
It's just Tyler wanting the power and like he's gonna martyr himself, and all of that's a little too clean in the movie. I think so not that one is better. I have this ongoing problem with Polanyi books, and the movie solves some of those. And that's my other personal one star is just that the ending is bad. Like the when he sits down and talks to a psychiatrist and he says, it's like the point of like what he's learned. He's like, we're not special, but we're not crap either. We just are. We just are, and what happens just happens. That is such a Kleenex wad ending. It is so weak. It is such a soft and pointless little summit. Oh, things just are with it. Shut up. You should have just stopped the book arbitrarily at some point 15 pages earlier. Did you do casting
So
call?
I did Stephen Hawking's casting call.
Stephen Hawking's casting call, the one that does not take time or space into consideration.
We do not take time and space into consideration when we are, in this case, recasting a movie. I did. I cast our big three
Me
main
too.
characters, that's all. So for our narrator, I went with James McAvoy.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah, have you seen Split?
I have, and I really enjoy that.
And that's why I picked him. That's why I picked him for this, because I feel like he was so he just he did such a good job in that. He did so well starring as like all those personalities and stuff, that I feel like he could do something fun with this role, and I feel like they could do a different they could do a different take or something, I think, with him.
Adam Driver.
Oh, that's a good pick. Yeah, he's
He's
weird.
a, he's I think he can play straight, and he's also a big guy.
He is. He is a big guy.
I would believe Adam Driver is also both a leader of men, but I can see him playing the like wishy-washy sort of the more straight-laced narrator as well.
Yeah. And that was just like what I saw in James McAvoy. It was like he can be both of these characters. He can pull off different, different presences.
Who did you do for Tyler?
Bruce Willis.
That's a good answer.
I know. I was really pleased with myself when that hit me, to be honest. I also think that's a good answer. I don't always feel strong about my casting calls, but I felt pretty good about Bruce Willis. 'Cause and I'll say this. I know nobody likes Brad Pitt anymore. Brad Pitt as Tyler was just an absolutely solid, like,
Why don't we like Brad Pitt anymore?
he's ruined the Tyler character. I don't know. I think people don't like Brad Pitt anymore. But I don't know why. I have no beef with him.
Did he do something?
I don't know, something with Angelina Jolie. His kids don't talk to him or something, so now I think other people don't like him. I think people think he's not good.
Well, we will put a pin in that in case
We'll put a pin in that.
in case it turns out he has done something terrible and you and I just don't read that kind of news.
And we just maybe just don't know about it. Yeah,
Yes.
no, there's a possibility that he's done something terrible and that we shouldn't like him. And that I don't know what it is. I have sort of zero opinion about today's Brad Pitt. I sort of have zero opinion. About 1990s Brad Pitt, I have a lot of opinions. And I think that he was a great actor and
This was also his
very good
this
looking.
was his comeback movie too, after like a string of like I don't know. He got
Joe
pot.
Pitts.
It was the Meet Joe Black, yeah, and
Oh, Meet Joe Black.
that was the one that was
Oh,
right.
Joe Pitt. Joe Pitt is the
The
vampire
vampire from
series.
the Charlie Huston series. That's a really good
Yeah.
if we ever do trashy series, we should do that one. Yeah.
That was a great series.
The
Come back to that. But yeah, so why people don't like him
he
now,
had
I
also
don't
done
know,
seven years in Tibet.
but he really hit a big he because he was great in this role. But when we're comparing the book and the movie, he did make Tyler really likable in a way that Tyler is not likable in the book, and I do not think is meant to be likable.
I think Tyler is more childish in the book. Like childish in a way that I just don't think Brad Pitt is going to. Brad Pitt is just too, he
Isn't
looks too cool
capable.
no matter what. He's like, if you get
Brad
him.
Pitt 100% looks he just like he looks he's too cool.
Yeah.
And he makes Tyler a very cool character, and that's what people respond to. That's why people like the movie. They're responding to Brad Pitt as Tyler.
And I think that Tyler is, and I love that movie, but I think Tyler is childish. I think he is a, like your friend who could never sit still in class and was always like into something like just, but also he was not super popular.
Yeah.
Anyhow, that's why I cast Elijah Wood with a shaved head. Or
Oh, interesting.
Daniel Radcliffe with a shaved head.
Ooh, and he does Unhinged really
It's
well.
important to me that they have a buzz cut.
He was in Equus.
Oh, I saw that.
Remember when he was in Equus?
I
Yeah.
saw both versions of Equus for some reason.
I don't know if I've ever seen the movie. I think I've only seen it in theater, but I'm fairly certain. But those are good choices. Those are good choices. If we were making this a little bit more book and a little bit less of like a cool 90s movie, those would be really excellent casts for Tyler. Because I think Tyler, like I said, I love Brad Pitt's Tyler Durden, and I just think that that is a huge part of what people respond to from the movie, because Brad Pitt is cool. Brad Pitt is at the height of cool and attractive during that time and in Fight Club. But I think that if we were but if so if we were remaking this with like our choices, Tyler would be a different. I mean, and I responded that's and I picked Bruce Willis because Bruce Willis is also cool. right? So I guess I had the movie in mind when I was doing the casting call. But if we were to make this a little bit more, slightly more book based, then I think that your choices for Tyler are better options. Tyler's not meant to be likable, I don't think.
No, I was trying to cast against Brad Pitt too because he had been so cool in the movie. So like I'd been circling like Tom Cruise would be interesting. But these are all people that like I'm casting because Brad Pitt set like a mold in the movie, and I think Tom Cruise could do
Yeah.
something interesting with that. And one that I was circling that was also, which is why I picked like just twitchy nervous energy versus
Yeah.
like cool and smooth. Another one that I was circling though that I almost wish I'd made my main one was Tom Hanks. He
As
is,
Tyler?
yeah, it's against type, but he is a charismatic person that we all love. Like, we all deeply love Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
You can imagine
But
that
you
a
know, when
bunch of
he played, but
disaffected
he,
guys would also like Tom Hanks, right? Or is that not a good.
yeah. And you know, he does play, I mean, he plays unlikable in the Elvis movie.
I think he's a great actor. I think it'd be interesting. He never really
He's an
does.
oh, he's an amazing
He doesn't
actor.
do a
But you know,
lot of like.
he plays a bad guy. He plays a bad guy essentially
Yeah.
in the Elvis movie, right? He's the colonel, and we don't like him.
He plays a sleazebag in the opening part of Cloud Atlas too.
I've only read the book.
You know the
I haven't
guy
seen the
who's
movie
di you know
yet.
the guy who's digging for teeth on the beach at the beginning of the book, who's going to kill the young doctor on the ship? He plays that guy. He plays like four guys.
Oh, wow.
Everyone in the movie plays like seven people, but he plays that guy at
Well,
the
yeah,
beginning.
because it's
Yeah.
because of the nature of the book. Fair enough. What about Marla?
I did Zendaya. This is also
Oh, interesting.
partially, I was just trying to put someone current in there.
I did not go current because of Stephen Hawking's
You don't have to.
theory of time, and I didn't have to, and so I went with Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Oh, she'd be good. She looks like Helena Bonham
Yeah.
Carter.
Yeah, she's all. I mean, she's. She has that weird off-putting. I love Maggie Gyllenhaal,
She was
but she has that
good.
weird off-putting energy.
She was good in that porn show. The one about like 42nd Street, New York back in the day, and the birth of the like peep show in the porn industry. James Franco was in it. It was a series, The Deuce.
I know what you're talking about, but I've not seen it.
She's good in that.
I didn't watch it.
And she plays like a kind of dark, like it's.
I felt like she could do dark and strange pretty well. I felt like she'd bring something interesting to Marla, I think.
So something that I thought about this because like they already made a movie that is like a very well-known version of the movie though, is that if someone were to make another Fight Club and put it out again today, they should do it with a non-white cast. It doesn't matter what the non-white is, but it would be more interesting to see the read of this kind of energy and anger and disaffectedness and I don't know, reaction to American culture through the eyes of black characters, Mexican characters, any kind of Hispanic characters, I don't, Ecuadorians, anyone's fine, Asian. Like, I think this book, if you're going to,
Indian.
Indian, if you're going to make it now again, since we've already got a version, and you're going to explore it in a way that is actually like saying something new about this take, because the book is so vague. I think we get the sense that the characters are white because the author is white, but it doesn't particularly matter. Like
It doesn't pre
there's nothing in the book
No,
that.
it's not specified in there. We think of them as white because the author's white and because we've seen the movie that stars two white men.
I mean, he might also
That
talk
I
about,
like that.
he
That
might talk
is.
about like pale Dipton. I think he's got some descriptions that do indicate that they are white, but Lakeith Stanfield plays Tyler Durden. Kiki Palmer is Marla, whatever the like that's how I think if you were to make it interesting
I
and
do think that.
give it
I do think
something.
that could be an interesting. That would be. It would be an. It would be the only way to remake this.
I think so because I mean the David Fincher it doesn't help that David Fincher went on to become one of the like paragons of cinema. Like it's if you're going to remake a movie of one of the most famous American directors,
Right.
you need to do something else. You can't just.
It's got to be different, and it would be an interesting read for this to not be about white men, and I think it would change some of the narrative
I mean, unless they are
around
going,
it.
yeah.
It would change some of that like current conversation, I think, around it if we were to look at this through a different lens.
No, I think it makes it like,
A different like racial lens. Yeah, that's interesting.
I don't think you have to change a lot of the like, I think it makes the work more interesting and like the same, like those 2 dozen ideas that are packed in here that we talked about that like make, everyone thinks that everyone else is misinterpreting the point. You've just got so much to work with that I think that's the most fun way to redo it is, Hasan Minhaj is in it. What did you do for You Know Who You Remind Me Of?
So we have so because we've done that this little series, starting with Bret Easton Ellis. I mean, I think that there are callbacks. I think that some of the you remind me of is Bret Easton Ellis and Joan Didion. I think those are some interest. Like I think those are some kind of authors that are similar. And then we talked about Vonnegut, with the repetition, and Vonnegut's writing is also direct. Slaughterhouse-Five specifically is, again, it's a novel that absolutely fails the Bechdel test. It is also it is a male novel. I mean, again,
Both of
that one
these
does
are.
not have the that one does not have some of the misogynistic like undertone that we've discussed a little bit with Fight Club. It's just a book about men, so therefore fails the Bechdel. But the writing I felt like was similar, and again, like just that concept. But then I also went with Hunter S. Thompson.
Oh, that's interesting.
In terms of, I feel like his writing style is also very like direct and sort of matter of fact, to the point.
Mine is blank. I wouldn't have thought of Vonnegut if you hadn't said it, but Vonnegut is the one, now that you say it, where I'm sort of like, I see that.
Slaughterhouse-Five is my spec is kind of specifically, I think, what it reminds me of.
I see it now that you've said it in Slaughterhouse-Five and Breakfast of Champions, the like episodic nature of it, the fact that the scenes kind of start in the middle and are sometimes not tied together until later, the callbacks back and forth. The very slippery use of narration. Like this book goes back and forth from first person to second person.
Right.
And it's done well. You almost don't notice it, but like the breaking of the rules when it comes to like who our narrator is and how we're being told the story. And this is like a lot of Vonnegut books, almost a book that seems to know it's a book. It seems to know that it's telling you a story. And but I couldn't think of it. I can see forward, like I read a book a year or two ago called Black Buck about a young black guy being an SDR in corporate America that I see a lot of like Polonic style trickling down to this like young author who wrote this. I read a book called The Atmospherians that feels very much like a poor redux of this. Which is also kind of about men in the same way. And even Otessa Moshfegh, how do you say her name?
Otessa Moshfegh.
Otessa Moshfegh. In my year of rest of relaxation, I see maybe the best synthesis of like, what is it? It's like before I read this, I didn't know that you could do some of the things that he does in this book in a book. Like I didn't know that some of these rules were allowed to be broken. I didn't know that you could necessarily format something this way and make the voice like this. My Year of Rest and Relaxation is the book that I read that seems like it, like the author, and I don't, this may come as a surprise to you. I'm going to say it anyway. I don't know Otessa Moshfegh personally. She's never talked to me. She's never spoken to me. But that is the book that I can feel like she read this or read some of his work and like synthesized some of the cool ideas in here into her own style the best. And like I feel like I see like a like an influence in that book in particular. Both its subject matter and the way that it tackles the subject matter and like the sort of wild for like the wild like narrative journey that that book goes on that like is not at all what you expect. But otherwise, I have a hard time thinking of anything that is like this.
I really had to dig.
I mean, Vonnegut is the one that like lands the most, like as like you said it, like I, but even it's still not exactly like that, but it seems the closest distant
Yeah, and
cousin.
even then it was really just in the writing style. It was in like the repetition and just sort of like the direct writing. And then again, like I said, in terms of Slaughterhouse-Five being an incredibly male novel.
Yeah.
In that it's about men,
Well, it's about World War II and only.
it's about World War II and the men specifically that were in it and how they were affected. There's very few females in the novel. This is also a book about men, and there's very few females, in the novel. But I had to dig for the same reason that I didn't it didn't readily lend itself. And like I said, I mean, it you know Brett Easton Ellis and Didion were in my head just because we've kind of done this series, starting with Brett Easton Ellis, writers that he's known, influenced by, associated with, and then sort of some of that like nihilism, and that humorous nihilism kind of pulling through this little series that we're doing. So I wouldn't have made a jump between Polanyi and Bret Easton Ellis or Didion without us kind of having come to it in this way. If we hadn't just been discussing those novels, and if they didn't kind of lead us into choosing to do this book,
I'll tell you the book it's the
this part of our
least like is The
series.
Secret History.
Yeah, these two books, I got nothing. They got nothing in common.
No, a practiced minimalism and a very practiced elegaic like
Maximalism.
maximalism. Yeah. Did you do quotes? I have one, two, three, four. I have four quotes.
I have four.
Can I go first?
You can kick us off. You go first. Yeah.
This is one of the ones that always comes up, but it still strikes me as funny every time I hear it. I don't know why, but I've always liked it. I think it's just such a funny thing to say. You are not a beautiful and unique snowflake. That's it. That's the quote. The first time they say it in the book, I laughed out loud. And in the movie, it's just that panning shot where Tyler's like eating an apple and he's got the bullhorn and they're working in the garden. He just goes, "You're not beautiful or unique snowflakes." And I just think it's a funny thing to say to a person.
That is
That's my only cheap, often quoted one. The rest are better pulls, I promise.
I mean it's a good line. So my first quote, our narrator is talking about his father, and he says, "Me, I knew my dad for about 6 years, but I don't remember anything. My dad, he starts a new family in a new town about every 6 years. This isn't so much like a family as it's like he's setting up a as it's like he sets up a franchise." That is something I've remembered from this book since I was from like being in high school, is that concept. Because I do think that's
He also pulls it through. He pulls it through to like the fight clubs get set up as franchises all over the cities. Tyler is father. Tyler is the replacement for God. Tyler is the replacement for your boss, as the replacement for your father. Goes around. He abandons our narrator
Yeah.
and goes off to set up other franchises.
And he goes, yeah. So I like that he pulls it through. And then, yeah, I just like that's, there are these types of people or fathers in the world, right? And so I just kind of like that. This isn't so much like a family as it's like he sets up a franchise. And I don't know. That's something that's always stuck with me, throughout the years.
My next one is a little long. I'm going to do it anyway. It's early on in the novel, and he is describing Chloe, the woman from one of the support groups, the one who dies. He's describing sort of what it must have been like as she died, like what it is like to live with one of these things and to die. And it starts, "At night, Chloe ran around the maze of her own collapsing veins and burst tubes, spraying hot lymph. Nerves surface as tripwires in the tissues. Abscesses swell in the tissue around her as hot white pearls. The overhead announcement, prepare to evacuate bowels in 10, in 9, 8, 7. Prepare to evacuate soul in 10, in 9, 8. Chloe splashing through the ankle-deep backup of renal fluid from her failed kidneys. Death will commence in 5, 4. Around her parasitic life spray paints her heart. 4, 3, 2. Chloe climbs hand over hand up the curdling lining of her own throat. Death to commence in 3, in 2. Moonlight shines in through the open mouth. Prepare for the last breath now. Evacuate now. And I pulled that one because it is, I think, that example we were talking about of like how this is well written. It's sad. It's creative. It's on point for like the thing that, I don't know, the sort of unknowably difficult thing to have this like thing inside you killing you as you try to fight against it. I don't know, burst tubes spraying hot lymph. All of that just was the first time I read it, that whole little section about, the soul evacuating the body is like you wind down and finally die was struck me. And it's one of the things I've always remembered from the book.
I actually only have one more quote. And it's just one that I thought was funny, to be honest. C coming off of yours, this is just one I thought was funny. My boss at work, he asked me what I was doing about the hole through my cheek that never heals. When I drink coffee, I told him I put two fingers over the hole so it won't leak.
Like that.
It's such an impert it's just like it's such an impertinent answer. I actually love how much we talk about the hole in his cheek
Yeah.
throughout the book. I love that he always refers to it as a butthole.
Yeah.
I love how much we talk about that hole in his cheek, and that is just a line that really made me, that just makes me laugh.
I only have one more too, actually, and I also have a funny one after that long one about Chloe dying. It's our narrator moaning about a situation, and he says, my wish right now is for me to die. I am nothing in the world compared to Tyler. I am helpless, I am stupid, and all I do is want and need things. My tiny life, my little shit job, my Swedish furniture. I never, no, never told anyone this, but before I met Tyler, I was planning to buy a dog and name it Entourage. This is how bad your life could get. The unspoken thing, the unwritten thing there is that if you buy a dog and name it Entourage, you can always be like, me and my entourage are coming. Like, he doesn't come right out and give us the like why that's so pathetic, but like
Why that's so
you
terrible,
can
yeah.
infer the like this, the commonplace cleverness that brings you to name a dog Entourage, that sort of like joke 2 million people have thought of.
Yeah. That was a good line.
Right, so that was Fight Club. Would you recommend it?
I would absolutely recommend
Yeah.
that people go through and read the book, because I think a lot, a lot of people have seen the movie, and I think it's nice to know where it comes from.
I would recommend that you read it and enjoy it, and you could probably skip a lot of the internet's hot takes and reviews and think pieces about it. And if you've heard that it is, I don't know, problematic or a red flag book, you should consider that it is not the fault of a piece of art, that there are some people out there who cannot mentally metabolize a narrative and points of view and things in the proper way. So, yeah, I would also recommend it. What are we doing next?
So, speaking of Otessa Moshfegh, we're going to kind of conclude our run of humorous nihilism that we've kind of been doing since starting with Bret Easton Ellis and sort of moving forward and moving through his circles. We are going to conclude with my year of rest and relaxation.
Nice. I like that book.
Me too. I'm excited to talk about it.
All right. And as always, please like or subscribe to our podcast wherever you happen to listen to it. If you have questions or would like to suggest some books or, I don't know, correct something you think we got wrong, you can write to us at readingpopclassics.com. You can follow us on Instagram at readingpopclassics and tune in next week. Not next week. tune in whenever this next one drops. It'll be a minute. We have to read a whole book.
And thanks for listening.